Well, hello and welcome back to series two of Breaking the Taboo. And for my regular listeners to the show, I'm sure you'll recognise my next two guests who came on our previous series. And with me today to answer your questions as listeners for our Ask Me Anything episode, I have with us Dr. Kim Thomas again, who is the Chief Executive of the Birth Trauma Association, a fantastic charity that supports parents experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder after birth. Kim was also the Secretariat for the All-Party Parliamentary Group's Inquiry into Birth Trauma and wrote the inquiry's report. And with me, I also have back Jill Castle, who is a former police officer who suffered a missed fourth degree tear during the birth of her only child a few years ago, which led to her colostomy and medical retirement from the police force and some mental health issues resulting from birth. And Jill has been a fantastic campaigner for changes to the maternity system in the UK. And you might recognise both of their voices because, of course, they came on in the first series to talk about birth trauma and introduce the subject to our listeners. And they were so popular that I've invited them back today to answer your listener questions. And just before I get on to contributions from the many listeners that we've had online, I just want to start off by reflecting, Kim, what an incredible response that we had to the first series. I remember when you and I first talked about it several months ago, and we wondered if anyone would be interested in listening to birth trauma on a podcast. I don't think any of us would have expected such a huge response from the public. I mean, nearly a million views in the very first month that we launched, straight into the podcast charts and the top five for Apple iTunes of most listened shows in the country for our health category. And just to start there, I mean, isn't that extraordinary to think that there wasn't another show out there where mothers could really get this information and provide resource and support for families? So why is it, Kim, do you think that Breaking the Taboo has been so popular?
Oh, you're right. It has been absolutely amazing. It's been so good to see how successful it's been. And I really think it's because there's nothing else like it out there. There's so little information for women about birth, you know, and those taboo subjects like birth injuries, like postpartum psychosis, but, you know, incontinence after birth, returning to work after you've had a traumatic birth and you've got physical injuries, all those things, they just don't get talked about, and it's so hard to find the information. So I think your podcast has really, really filled a gap, and it's just been wonderful to see such a positive response to it.
And Jill, I was struck as well because you wrote your story down for my book, which was recently published in May, Breaking the Taboo. And if I think back sort of 10, 20 years ago, no one was discussing this stuff. I mean, the fact that you and I have both written our stories down and it's being discussed in the national media hopefully shows how we've really moved the conversation on and have started to break the shame and the sort of taboo in society, really, about speaking about these issues.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the key thing about the podcast as well is that it's just accessible. You know, you've got lots of different people talking about lots of different things in an accessible way. And I think there's just been a need for it. So, yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to be invited back on. Just goes to show there's a lot more for us still to do.
Yeah, and what's interesting reading listener comments is I think mums are so busy and they never have a spare hand. So actually sitting down to read something or type is very difficult. But actually listening and having it on the school run in the car or just having it in your back pocket as you're doing the washing up is something they can all do. Brilliant. So I'm going to put you both in the hot seat for today's questions. And we've had so many coming in from families, a lot on Instagram, on TikTok, on Facebook, of mums with questions. So Jill, if I could perhaps start with you. Our first question is, what should I put into my birth plan and will it be followed?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting question because we're all presented with this idea at the beginning of your pregnancy that the birth plan is something that you can put in lots and lots of ideas about what you expect and hope to have as a result of your birth or through the birth, sorry, in the labour. You know, people go for things as far-fetched as what the exact kind of music that they want to have, what they're going to wear, where they're going to give birth, how they're going to give birth, lots and lots of detail that goes into these birth plans. And I think that it is sensible to have a birth plan because people do need to know what it is that you expect and you want. But I think often what does happen when it actually gets to the reality of having a baby is these birth plans aren't necessarily followed. And you might actually forget what you put in them I forgot what I put in mine. I forgot that actually I'd put in not to offer me any pain relief until I asked for some, because I thought I would be the one who would realise when I needed to have it the most. So then I wondered why nobody offered me any pain relief, but that's because I've actually written that on my birth plan. So I think sometimes in the heat of the moment, you'll forget what's in there anyway, and it might not be as relevant as you might think when you're not actually in the process of giving birth. I think what's really sensible to put in is things like what you would like in terms of pain relief, what you'd categorically do not want to have. I think that's very important. I think it's important that you are giving some idea of your consent for things that might happen during the birth. For example, if you would say, I definitely do not want to have a C-section for these reasons. Yes, they might not follow that, because when it's an emergency, you know, your life and the life of the baby comes first over what your preference might be. But I think it is a good document so that people in the room have an idea of the way that you would like things to go, if possible.
And if I could just add to that, something that came up on an earlier episode that I did with some dads was they said that they'd wish they discussed with their partner in advance that in the case that something does go wrong, like, for example, if your baby ends up in the NICU unit, like, do you want them to stay with them as the mum or go and be with the baby? So when you're in a really high, stressful environment, you know, when you've just given birth or you've been in labour for a long time, that's probably not the best time to be having a really in-depth conversation with your partner. So I think thinking about those questions in advance is really helpful. And I think recognising, as you said, that everything might not go to plan. So it's a list of things that you'd like to have considered, but I think also be flexible and be prepared to realise that, you know, it is a natural process giving birth and not everything will necessarily go exactly as you plan. So having that kind of flexibility is important too.
I would like to say that you've made a really good point about bringing birth partners and what you want their role to be. I think this is a really important part to bring into a birth plan, because that can sort of bring those people into the minds of the professionals who are there helping you give birth, because sometimes birth partners do get forgotten about. So I think if that's in your birth plan, it might just sort of jog people to actually think about what their role is in the room. So I think that's really important as well.
And I think that leads on really well, actually, to the next question that I've had. And Kim, you and I have discussed this before about kind of rights in childbirth. And I think a lot of families don't actually know what their rights are ahead of time. I certainly didn't when I gave birth to my daughter. And I think having an advocate and a voice during childbirth is so important. So the question that's come in for you is, how should they use their voice and advocate for themselves when their family or medics are not listening?
I do think this is a really good question, but it's also a difficult question, because when you're giving birth, you're really you're very, very vulnerable. And so how to advocate for yourself at a time when you feel vulnerable is particularly difficult. And it's difficult anyway. You know, you might go into GP surgery and GP isn't listening to you. And it can be quite hard to be assertive in those circumstances. So I think what I'd say is, know your rights before you go into the birth room. And the birthright site is a very good site that kind of explains what your legal rights are. And that includes, you know, the right to say no to anything. So if you don't want a vaginal examination, for example, you don't have to have one. So I think that's very important to know that. And I would also suggest doing your research beforehand, so you know what is likely to happen and what might be offered, what might go wrong, so that you kind of know what sort of decision you want to make when that happens. I would also suggest really have a very good conversation with your birth partner, you know, whether that's your actual life partner or whether it's, you know, you're taking your mum in or whoever with you, about what you want and how you want them to advocate for you, because it's really important sometimes that if you're not in a very good state, that they will speak up for you and say what, you know, speak on your behalf and say what you want to happen. And you know, I have heard stories like that where the partner has made a really important intervention that has actually ended up saving the mum's life, because the mum might be so unwell, and the, you know, the health professionals aren't picking up on it, and the partner's advocating for you. And I think the other thing is just to kind of be firm and be calm and kind of restate your position sometimes. So if they're not listening, you could just keep saying it until they do listen. And I suppose the other thing is sometimes you might want to have more than one person in the room with you. So if we wanted a doula, for example, you know, doulas can be quite good at advocating for women. I would say make sure you choose a good doula who's right for you, because doulas aren't regulated in the UK. So make sure you're happy with the doula you choose. And if you, for example, have a disability, or you have, in English isn't your first language, you have the right to have somebody in with you to act as an interpreter on top of your birth partner. So I think all those things are really important. But I mean, I think that'd be my prime thing, would be kind of know your rights before getting into the birth room and make sure you're kind of clued up about that.
I think you made a really important point there, Kim, about keep asking if you're not being listened to. And I think it goes back actually to Jill's point earlier as well, of if you've had these conversations with your partner, that they can also help you. And I'll give you just an example from myself. You know, I hopefully think I'm quite a confident and, you know, person who's able to advocate on my behalf. But what was very interesting during labour is that I became very sort of introverted, very focused on myself, my body, my breathing, and was really probably not acting in the normal character that I would be sort of day to day in a work context. So my husband advocating for me became a much bigger and important point during labour than it would have been in a different context. So the fact that he really knew in advance what to ask for. And the specific example I'd give listeners is I have a very huge phobia of needles and blood. And when I had to have the epidural and I had to have an IV and a cannula in my hands, I was very, very distressed. I was, you know, crying. I was quite hysterical. I was really not able to speak to the medical professionals in the hospital. And it was my husband who was speaking to the anaesthetist saying, she's got this extreme phobia. You need to read her notes. It's really important. You only have one chance to get it in the vein. You won't have another opportunity. And actually it was him having those conversations with the nurses, not me. But because we'd had those conversations in advance about my phobias, he was able to have those conversations. So I think that's really important. And I suppose that combines with a second point, Kim, just about rights in childbirth. So if they don't feel like they're being listened to by a medical professional, is there any advice that you give them in that specific situation?
I mean, that is a hard one, really. I think all you can do is just be persistent and advocate for yourself. I think that's the best thing you can do, really, and ask your partner to advocate for you as well. You could restate that you know what your legal rights are. I think, you know, that could be helpful. You could say, look, I don't want you to do this, and it's my right to say no to this. And that is absolutely your legal right. You don't have to have any medical procedure that you don't want.
Yeah, that's a really important point, actually, for people to know that it's their body and ultimately, you know, they can decide. Okay, so we've had loads of questions coming in about birth injuries. We did an earlier episode with the charity MASIC in the previous series, where we talked in quite a lot of detail about third degree tears and what an anal obstetric sphincter injury was. But I was really struck by kind of listener feedback, Jill, particularly that a lot of women didn't know about birth injuries. They didn't know that they might end up having something go wrong during a vaginal delivery. I think it's really important not to, you know, scare mums who are pregnant listening to the show and say that it's still a very small proportion of births. So both myself and Jill did suffer from a significant tear, but we're still in the minority of births. And I think most people will go on to have a good and successful birth. So firstly, Jill, if I could just come to you first about birth injuries as you've had your own. Could you just tell mums a little bit about what they are? And then perhaps, Kim, I could come to you specifically about prolapse and some of the other things that might also occur.
Yeah, so like you said, Theo, there is not a lot of information before you go in to have a baby about possible injuries. And yes, they are rare. But I think for me, I think what would be beneficial is that if you are given more information about what might happen, but then at the same time, what support is available to you if you do get injured? So the injuries that you can get are, for example, the perineal tears. You have four categories of perineal tear, which goes from the first degree tear, which is basically a little bit like a paper cut, all the way through to a fourth degree tear, which is quite severe. Well, it's very severe. It's all the way through the internal, the external sphincter. And that's a tear all the way through the rectum and the vagina. So that is something that would lead to incontinence. You can also get fistulas, which are even rarer than these severe tears. A fistula is an abnormal connection in the body. So that basically means a hole where there isn't meant to be one. And in childbirth, that would tend to be a rectovaginal fistula, which is between the rectum and the vagina, which is what I had. You can also have damages from C-section as well. Some people can get their bowel nicked. But again, these are extremely rare cases. But I think what's most important to know is what you can do about it if you do get one.
And can I just ask specifically, Jill? So if a mum has gone home and thinks that, for example, they're going to the toilet and everything is just not feeling normal or how they're expecting post-birth, like what are the sort of symptoms they should be looking out for, and when should they seek help?
So for me, my first symptom was the fact that I had, it was a brown smear on my underwear, which then I realised it was fecal matter. It was poo. So that was the first. And, you know, this sounds grim, but you can smell your underwear. You can actually smell what's there. And then you will know whether that is healing tissue or it's bodily waste. I think also if the area where you're injured or where you've given birth is very, very hot and very, very painful, that's also a warning sign, because you should be getting better. You should be improving. You shouldn't be getting worse and worse and worse. For me, my tear just got more and more painful and hotter and hotter and hotter until I couldn't even touch it. So yes, it should be sensitive at the beginning, but it should start to get better. And I think they're the warning signs. If increased heat, increased pain, and you've got something in your underwear that shouldn't be there and doesn't smell right, then that indicates it's not right. And that's when I would definitely go wherever to get help, even go to A&E. That's where I went. But you need to get medical attention to stop infection.
I think it's really important, Jill, that you specify in quite graphic detail what you mean. And the whole point of this podcast, right, is to break the taboo by talking about this stuff. So if anyone is listening to the show today and you are worried, you know, please do reach out to a charity like MASIC or ring your GP and try and get some medical help as soon as possible. Don't feel any shame about it. You know, this has happened to you, not because of you, and there is definitely support out there. And Kim, there are so many things that, you know, could change with your body post-birth. You know, prolapse is something that I've had so many messages about on social media in the last few weeks, with a lot of mums saying, you know, I'd never heard of it before, Theo. You know, what is it? What can I do about it? So could you just tell listeners to the show who are maybe not aware of what a prolapse is, just a bit about it and any advice?
Yes, of course. It is relatively common, actually, after childbirth. So your pelvic floor muscles hold up, their job is to sort of hold up your bowel, your bladder, and your uterus. And what can happen during childbirth is those muscles weaken, and then one of those organs can drop down into your vagina, which is obviously quite, you know, very distressing and quite alarming. And the typical symptom is a kind of heavy sort of dragging feeling if that happens. And sometimes it can be so bad you can actually see the organ bulging out. I mean, it doesn't always get that bad, but it can get that bad. And it often happens when you have had, say, a third or fourth degree tear. You know, the two things go together. And so it's very, very important to seek treatment for this, because it's, you know, it's an awful thing to happen. And there is treatment, so you can get physiotherapy to strengthen your pelvic floor muscles. You can also get pessaries to keep the organs in place, or in sort of more severe cases, you can get surgery to kind of make sure the organ is properly attached. That's quite unusual. So, you know, one of the first two options will usually work for most women. It is really important to get help. And, you know, as with so many of these injuries, sometimes women find they're being dismissed by doctors when they go and report it. So you do need to be persistent as well in looking for help, and also don't kind of be embarrassed about it, because it is just one of those things that happens sometimes, and it is really important to get it seen too.
And I think you make such an important point, Kim, of just not just to leave it. I mean, you just remind me, I did an episode at the beginning of this series with Belle Donati, who interviewed me about writing Breaking the Taboo. And she just casually mentioned that she'd been living with a prolapse and she didn't think anything of it. And it was only now when she's been working with me on this birth trauma campaign that she realised that, you know, she should probably get some help for it. And I was just so shocked from one of my closest friends. And she just said that, you know, on the early episode of the podcast. And, you know, if you have had significant physical changes to your body post-birth, you absolutely should be asking for help with your recovery. And Jill, that's why I was so keen to have you back on the podcast, because I think your story is so inspiring of how you did have such a difficult time, but you've really become such a champion for kind of living life to the full, you know, swimming the channel as the first person solo with a stoma bag, and all the work that you do in Kenya to support other mums who've been living, you know, after a fistula. So I want to turn on to a new topic, which is something that we get a lot of comments about, particularly on TikTok, which is about breastfeeding, which I know is a very controversial subject to wade into. But the particular topic listeners are interested in is about the pressure to breastfeed, particularly when they were unable to produce milk after a traumatic birth. So Jill, I wondered if you could sort of pick up on that and make listeners feel a bit less alone who've had that experience.
I just want to say that I really, really sympathise with women who this happens to, because it happened to me and it's horrendous. I think, in fairness to the midwives and the medical profession, they don't do this because they hate you as a mother. I think they are very anxious to give women the opportunity to breastfeed if they're able to, and they don't want this opportunity to disappear without trying to help you at the start. So that's the way I've kind of got my head around why there is so much pressure. But I think it's very, very difficult to withstand that pressure and to not feel like you're a complete failure when you don't produce the milk, when, you know, you've got lactation nurses squeezing your nipples, and you do feel like a dairy cow just hauled about all over the place, and then you've got suction caps on you and you're still not producing any milk. I do remember my husband actually tipping over a tiny little bit of milk that I'd managed to express, and how we managed to survive that moment in our marriage, I don't know, because it took so much effort to get out. And it wasn't until probably about a week after I'd had the baby that I had the strength actually to say, enough, I am not doing this anymore. I am going to bottle feed my baby because he's hungry. I need somebody else to help me feed him. I need to get better as a mum, and I need my baby to thrive, and I need my husband to be able to get involved. And actually, by doing that, I felt empowered. And it was sort of like a little insight into me, realizing that just because I'm not breastfeeding and just because I'm not following what all these other people seem to think I should be doing, it doesn't mean that I wasn't actually doing the best for my baby and for myself and my family. But there is a lot of pressure, and it is very difficult. But I just think it's really important to hold on to whatever decision you make about feeding your baby is the right one, because you've made it and you're the mum. So and the baby will be fine. Regardless, the baby will be fine. You know, there's always a bit of a laugh in our family about the fact that my husband was formula fed. I mean, he's 6 foot odd. He's a former Royal Marine. He's built like a mountain. And we always used to say, well, you would never point at him in the street and say, well, I bet he was formula fed as a baby.
So true. And you know, you just reminded me as well, I think it's really important to say to mothers listening that, you know, don't pressurize yourself. And I think if you suffered a postpartum hemorrhage like I did, I lost a lot of blood, you know, my body was just fighting to stay alive and to recover, and basically producing milk, I think, was the last thing on my body's mind. So I didn't get milk for several days, and I did have to feed my daughter formula right from the moment when she was born, because I just simply couldn't produce the milk. And I think I had all these expectations before my daughter arrived that, you know, she's going to magically crawl up my chest and she was just going to start breastfeeding. And, you know, that's what I planned to do for several months. And I think it's the society expectations sometimes that make it worse, that we'd plan to do something and then maybe we weren't able to do so, because it's just very difficult sometimes when your body's been through a long traumatic process to produce milk. So I think whoever's listening today, do what's right for you. And I think as long as your baby is fed and well, from my perspective, that's the most important thing. And don't feel pressurized by anybody. Do what's right for you. Okay, perfect. If we go into the next question. So we've got so many coming in. It's hard to pick just a few for today's episode. But we've got a lot of questions, Kim, about maternal mental health. And if I could just read out one mum's comment. She said, how can I find maternal mental health services in my area? I can't find anything online because Google is confusing me. I think we can all relate to that. You go yes. on Google and there's just sort of a billion results. So how should they find that information, and where is a good place to signpost them to?
And it is actually incredibly complicated, you know, the provision of mental health services in this country for new mothers. I mean, it took me a while to get my head around it. So there's two types of provision, really. There's something called perinatal mental health services, and these are kind of community services. They've been around for a while. They're available all over the country, so Wales, England, Scotland, Northern Ireland. And they're kind of specialist multidisciplinary teams. So they'll have a psychologist and a mental health nurse and a psychiatrist. And these sort of community teams are designed to help women who've had serious mental health problems after childbirth. So, I mean, that would include psychosis, which, of course, I think we're going to talk about maybe a bit later. But also, you know, sort of severe depression, OCD, you know, maybe other kind of problems as well. So those are kind of perinatal mental health services, and they've been expanded in the past few years, which is good. But separate from that, you have maternal mental health services, and they've only been around since 2018, and they've been rolled out gradually since then. They're only available in England. And maternal mental health services were set up specifically to deal with mental health problems that have arisen as a result of your birth. So baby loss, and that includes not just women whose babies have died, but whose babies have maybe been taken into care. Post-traumatic stress disorder from the birth, and tocophobia as well, which is fear of giving birth. And those services specifically deal with those problems. If you want access to those services, you have to have a referral. So you have to go to your GP and ask for a referral. You can't self-refer to them. So in a way, it doesn't really matter if you can't find them online, because you're going to have to go to your GP anyway to ask for them. And I think that those services, although it's really, really good that they've been set up, and that, you know, that there is now a service that can support you with birth trauma or baby loss, the provision has been quite patchy because they are under-resourced. One of the services has already had to close down, unfortunately. Some of them are not fully set up to deal with all the things they're supposed to deal with. So they might support you with birth trauma, but not with baby loss, for example. So there are a lot of issues with them. So, you know, they're a good thing in theory. In practice, we're not all the way there yet. And also, they're only available in England. So if you're in Wales, Scotland and Ireland, maternal mental health services don't exist, and you would have to go and get a referral to therapy.
So what I'll possibly do, Kim, is maybe pop in the show notes for listeners some links to groups like Maternal Mental Health Alliance, which have things like a postcode finder on it, so they can pop in where they live and see what other local service providers. And you made an important point there, Kim, about also being referred. So I think a lot of mums feel quite stigmatised and shame about talking about mental health issues when they've had their baby. You know, in very extreme examples, I've heard mums saying, you know, they were exhibiting, you know, extreme symptoms of depression or PTSD, and they're worried about their babies being taken to care. So that's why they didn't reach out to local authority services to get support. But I think it's really important that they do get support. I was referred by my local service in Staffordshire to a fantastic organisation called the Lotus Service. And I should caveat that by saying I was very anti trying any therapy before. I didn't think it was something that would work on me. I was pretty sceptical, to be honest, about the whole approach. And it was really my husband who said to me he really thought it would help me to process the very traumatic experience I had giving birth. And I have to say, it made such a huge difference. So if anyone is out there listening today and is on the fence thinking, you know, should I pick up the phone? Should I ask for a referral or to try and find a service? You know, it did work for me. It's worked for many other women that we speak to. Jill has put her hand up, so I'll bring you in next. But I think it's really important that mums do ask for help. Jill, what would you like to add?
Yes, I would just like to reiterate your point, actually. And like you said before, I have recovered really well and I've done lots of fabulous things, but I started with the basics at the very beginning, reaching out, getting help, having counselling. I do actually do Reiki as well, which has been transformational for me. So I would just say, go into everything with an open mind. Just embrace what is out there and give everything a go. You've got nothing to lose.
Yeah, such a good point. Okay, so if we could turn on to a different topic, we've interestingly had a lot of fathers also listening to the show. Some of you may have listened to my earlier episode in the first series where we talked specifically about dads who'd witnessed a traumatic birth, many of whom had gone on to develop PTSD. So if you haven't listened to that episode, do dig it out because it's well worth listening to when you've got two dads and their perspective. So, Jill, if I could come back to you, I mean, your partner obviously had a very difficult time having to look after you and your newborn baby. How do you think that families can best support someone like you with birth trauma? And have you got any sort of words of advice for dads out there who are wondering how best to support the mum who might have had a difficult birth?
From my experience, patience is the number one thing that anybody can do, partner, family, friends, and giving people the space to get better. And you can do that by doing what looks like little things that are actually really, really important. Things like making sure they get a cup of tea, making sure that you're helping with the laundry, making sure that they're eating well and that you're providing good food. It's all these things that seem really normal and boring and basic, but actually if those things are taken care of and people are given the space to get better, then they're much more likely to do so. And like I've said, it's just being really patient and having that hope and that belief in your partner that they will get better. It's extremely difficult for a partner because I certainly pushed my husband away. I couldn't deal with, and I don't mean that physically, I mean that emotionally, because I wasn't able to put into words my own emotions. And I just couldn't speak to him. And he just had to watch me suffer, really. But his quiet, solid presence in the background was a massive comfort to me. He didn't ask anything of me. He didn't ask me too many questions. He just let me breathe and recover and was there for me. And that all sounds very wishy-washy and a bit basic, but sometimes if you question someone too much and you're trying to drag up too much information out of them, it's not actually helpful. Sometimes you're doing that because you want answers and that's not actually necessarily what they need at that time.
And I think it's really important that we recognise that it can be really difficult for the dads too. And I was so struck when we did our early episode where we had two dads on the show, that first of all, they were suddenly looking after a newborn baby when the mother wasn't well enough to look after the baby themselves. And they were completely not expecting it. Obviously, paternity leave in the UK is only 2 weeks, which is obviously not enough for any of us who've had a really difficult and complicated birth. And I think it goes back to your earlier birth plan point about if you've had these conversations to say, you know, how can I be most helpful in the first few days when the baby arrives? Just even the little things, like I remember one of the nicest things anyone did for me was one of our neighbours just basically sent me about 10 deliveries of food. And obviously my husband and I were so tired from looking after a newborn baby. And I was pretty much bedbound for the first few weeks and didn't leave the house. And so not having to cook and the fact that someone had just thought of us and had just literally sent us a delivery of some really nice sort of home cooked food just made all the difference. It's just one less job you have to do. So I think, you know, do think in advance about those little things that can be done. And I think asking the whole family to step up, and even if it's just, you know, watching the baby to sleep outside in the garden for half an hour so you can go and have a shower, like even those little things just, I think, make such a difference. And that's where families can play such a big role. Okay, so on to a new topic. Let me just have a scroll through because there are so many messages coming in from listeners. Oh, this is a good one, Kim. So postpartum psychosis has come up quite a few times. Not something I think we talk about enough in society, certainly not an everyday term that many families will have heard of. So could you just tell us briefly, you know, what is it and what are the signs that any families should be looking out for if they're concerned that the mother's exhibiting signs which are very out of character?
Yes, of course. So postpartum psychosis is mercifully quite rare. So it affects about between 1 in 1,000 and 1 and 2 in 1,000 women. So it's only probably about 600 or 1,000 women a year in the UK. But it's much more serious and much more alarming, really, than, say, you know, the postpartum depression or the other mental illnesses you can get. So women become delusional It typically sort of sets in a few days or maybe a few weeks after giving birth. So women, they might start having hallucinations. They might become very confused. You know, heart starts racing. They might imagine people are trying to hurt them. They might think their baby isn't their baby. They might not be able to sleep. You know, they're all these things. And of course, one of the key things is when you're that ill, you don't necessarily know that you're ill. It's not like, you know, if you have depression, you probably suspect that something's wrong, or if you have PTSD, you know that something's wrong. If you have psychosis, you're actually in a state where you don't realise that something's wrong with you. So it's really important for other people to watch out for signs of psychosis and make sure you get help. And then if you do get help, you'll need to be admitted to a psychiatric unit. Now, ideally, this will be a mother and baby unit. There are 22 in the UK, I think, just specially set up to support women who are having this kind of mental health crisis. And you can take your baby with you, which is really good. But, you know, there probably aren't enough mother and baby units, and sometimes they're full, there isn't a place, so women have to go to a general psychiatric ward instead, which is not ideal. But you will be supported, and you know, there's medication you can take antipsychotic medication that will kind of quite quickly return you to normal. So I mean, that's the good news, really, is that it's very, very treatable. And I think you did a whole episode, didn't you, Theo, on postpartum psychosis, where a doctor called Sally talked very movingly about her own experience of having postpartum psychosis and how she was helped to recover.
Yeah, I mean, I really recommend that listeners who are interested in that specific topic do listen to the whole episode that we did about this. So Action on Postpartum Psychosis came on and spoke in great detail about the work of their charity. So do have a look at that. And I think what was interesting talking to them was how, you know, mothers who'd never had any history of mental health had also exhibited these symptoms. And I think it's quite clear when something is very extreme, it's very different to the kind of post-birth baby blues or having postnatal depression. This is like a full sort of psychotic break from reality. So they really do need to have urgent medical help. So I'll pop in a link to that in the show notes as well. And I have got another question for you, Kim, which is, if I just read it out, says, I'm a mother whose son was brain damaged due to medical negligence. I feel like this is a topic that's not talked about enough, Theo. Where can I get help? And firstly, gosh, Kim, how awful to hear that experience from that mother who's written in. And unfortunately, you and I heard so many similar stories when we chaired the Birth Trauma Inquiry report and wrote our sort of landmark inquiry into this in the House of Commons. So could you tell us a bit about that? And specifically, is there any resources that you'd like to signpost families to?
Yes. I mean, I think in terms of getting sort of medical help and sort of day-to-day living, I mean, there's a very good charity called PEEPS, H-I-E, which supports people with this kind of, with hypoxic brain injury, it's called, which is brain injury that results from being starved of oxygen. And it's worth going to their website because they've got plenty of resources. Or obviously medical help, you know, you would get through the NHS, and it sometimes, you do need to be persistent in getting that help. And it's often very difficult for those families getting things like an education and health plan in place, or, you know, what used to be called a statement of special educational needs. But it's really important to try and do that. And you might need to get legal help in getting that in place to make sure your child has the support that they need. I wonder if the question is also asking about what legal help is available, you know, if something like that has happened. So I think the thing to note is it can often be really important if your child has a brain injury as the result of medical negligence during birth, that you do take legal action. And I know a lot of people are reluctant to do that because they think it's taking money from the NHS, but actually it's really important to do that if your child has a brain injury, because they're going to need support for the rest of their life. And that money will help you give, you know, your child the support they're going to need. And so I would always recommend that you find a really reputable law firm, one that specialises in obstetric negligence, one where they've got expertise in brain injuries at birth. And there are a few of these around, and the Birth Trauma Association has 6 trusted legal partners who we would recommend, and they're on our website. But the other thing that's worth noting is that generally with medical negligence, there isn't legal aid and firms take a case on the basis of a no-win, no-fee system. But with brain injuries to the child, there is legal aid available. So find a firm that accepts legal aid, because that will make it a little bit easier for you. And it means you won't have to kind of pay a success fee, I think it's called. You want to put, the law firm won't take a proportion of the money that you were awarded, if you are awarded. And I suppose finally the point to say about that is normally in medical negligence cases you have only 3 years to make the claim, but with a brain injury from birth you have up to the date of your child's 21st birthday, so you've got plenty of time to kind of think about that and act on it. But I think it's certainly something that's worth doing.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And I know the firms that you mentioned, Kim, and one that jumps to mind is Owen Mitchell. I've met with some of their lawyers. They're a very good team, and I'm sure they could definitely provide some practical advice. Okay, we're running out of time, ladies. Got 10 minutes to go. So next, I want to turn to a topic that we don't talk enough about, which is sex post-birth. And this is definitely the taboo subject that no one wants to be seen asking friends or family, but I think is the number one topic everyone really wants to know the answer to. And it reminds me, Jo, when I had my perineal tear clinic appointments, literally the first question the specialist asked me was, you know, do you want contraception? Here's some lubricant. I think I nearly fell off my chair. That was about the last thing I was thinking of when I've been very heavily bleeding for several weeks and basically couldn't even sit down on my perineum as it was so damaged. So could you talk a bit about contraception post-birth and, you know, when do we think it is okay for women to have sex if they've had a traumatic birth and are obviously very understandably worried about it and if they will be able to have intercourse properly after such a difficult experience?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a bit tricky to answer this one in terms of the fact that obviously everyone's body is different and you will have a different injury, different recovery, and all that kind of thing. So it's difficult to give obviously a blanket response. But what I would say is you do know your own body, and your partner, I presume, should be very patient and should wait for you to feel able to have sex. Now, of course, you don't just have to have penetrative sex. So you could do lots of other things before you actually go on to have full penetrative sex. You could also use things like vibrators just to see what it feels like up there, you know, to feel if it has healed at all. And of course, I would always seek advice primarily from a doctor, really, if you just wanted to make absolutely sure. I think a lot of us are very worried about the stitches coming out or re-tearing or something happening to the injury that has now healed. You know, that can be quite a bit of concern, but you can use lubrication. You can just take it slowly. You can definitely have sex again after you've had a really serious injury like I had. I did actually get pregnant again. Lots of us go on to have children after a severe childbirth injury. So it's definitely possible, but I think it's something that just has to be done with compassion and understanding with your partner, to not rush you and just to wait until you're ready. But it will depend on your individual injury, really, as to when that can happen. But yeah, I mean, I did, like you, Theo, I did used to laugh when I would go to appointments very early on and they would say, are there any chances that you're pregnant? And I'd say, absolutely none. My contraception is no sex.
And also the other thing that strikes me talking to you, Jill, is that, you know, we're quite open about speaking about this, but I think a lot of women don't feel comfortable talking about very personal things. But I think when you've had, you know, a birth injury or you've had PTSD post-birth and you do find these things either physically uncomfortable or very triggering for you. So in my case, I had a huge amount of vaginal examinations during my induction, and that meant having sex was very painful for me. And obviously having stitches meant it took several months for, you know, the area to recover properly. But I think it's just important to take it slowly. And in fact, it reminds me, I remember my specialist said to me, try using tampons instead of sanitary towels after a certain point, just to kind of get used to the area. And I think that was really good advice, actually, to kind of sort of slowly build yourself up. So there we go. We are breaking the ultimate taboo by talking about sex post-birth, ladies. And actually, there's a lot of stuff you can also do post-birth to help with your pelvic health. And there's a good episode we did a few months ago where we have some pelvic health and a Pilates coach come in and talk about your post-birth body and what you can do to help get it back in shape. So do listen to that. And finally, Kim, a question for you. Something we haven't talked about enough actually on the show is about premature babies. And we've heard some very distressing stories from mothers being separated from their babies in the NICU. And we know that it can have some real ramifications for bonding with the baby. So I'll probably maybe come to both of you on this question. Firstly, do you have any advice, Kim, for mums who've had a premature baby, if they're worried about, you know, bonding with their baby, building that special connection, because they've obviously not been able to do skin to skin, the baby's in an incubator, they've not been able to hold it. And I think a lot of women are feeling a lot of grief about that. They feel like they didn't have the experience they were expecting post-birth, and it's very difficult. So what would you advise?
My heart does go out to those women, because I think everybody kind of dreams of that moment when you hold your baby after it's born and you have that kind of first skin to skin and that first cuddle. And it's so hard for these new mums to see their baby in an incubator and not be able to hold their baby. I would say sort of talk to your baby, you know, because your baby will recognise your voice. I think that's something we know. You know, the babies recognise their mother's voice as soon as they're born because they're used to hearing it in the womb. And if you are allowed to take your baby out for a little while and hold it, obviously you can do that. And I think when your baby is home, then that bond will happen. You know, you can have as many cuddles as you want once your baby's home, and you will bond with your baby. But I think Jill has probably got more kind of expertise on this than I do, really.
Yeah. So I didn't bond with my baby because obviously I had a very traumatic birth and he was whisked away when he was born. I didn't meet him for 6 hours. And then when we were introduced, it was the middle of the night and it was all very quiet. And then I was just too poorly, too traumatized. And it was quite interesting, actually, because I didn't bond with him until he was 7 months old and we moved home back to the support of my family, because I was 150 miles away from my family. And it was at that moment I fell in love with my son, and I remember the specific moment when that happened. And I think that's because that's when I felt safe and when I felt secure, and my body was able to permit me to feel that kind of emotion, because love is very overpowering and it makes you very vulnerable. And when you're very poorly, you don't have the capacity to allow that kind of emotion into your life. So I think you will get that bond, but I think it also sometimes goes hand in hand with the rest of your life calming down and you having that space to build that bond. And now my son's nearly 14 and I absolutely love the bones of him. And in a funny way, I'm almost pleased that I did get that bond a little bit later, because I remember it so clearly, the physical reaction that I had. But it's very distressing. It's very distressing. It's not distressing at the time because you don't realise. It's afterwards when you realise that you haven't bonded. It's extremely distressing, but it does come. It does come. You know, it comes with time. Everything comes with time. Bonding, healing, happiness, joy, sex, it all comes with time.
Yeah, I think that's such good advice. And just reading another comment from mum, she said she feels grief because she was put under a general anaesthetic for birth and has no recollection of meeting her child. And gosh, I really feel for you. And I think what Jill and Kim are saying is, you know, don't beat yourself up, and these things do take time. And back to my earlier point about kind of society expectations of, you know, not everything is going to be the textbook birth. And that's okay. And don't beat yourself up if you haven't had the perfect experience that you were expecting. Well, it's already time to wrap up the episode, ladies. So thank you so much for coming on today's episode of Ask Me Anything for Breaking the Taboo. And first, I think it's so helpful to read the comments that are coming into the show to see what mums and families want to hear about. And I think you've both given some really practical and helpful advice. And in the show notes, listeners will find some really useful links to some of the different charities and the groups that they both mentioned. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do rate it in iTunes. Please do share it with friends and family. This is very much here to be a resource for affected families. So thank you both coming on the show, and look forward to future episodes of Breaking the Taboo. So stay tuned for next week's episode. Thanks so much.